Welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today, to make it up to you for doing a whole episode about bacon.
And corned beef.
Oh, yeah. Like, kind of right in a row. We're talking about a vegetarian protein source.
We are. And it is a really fun one. It was a fun one to research.
Oh, absolutely. I'm super excited about it.
Yeah.
It's tempeh.
Tempeh.
Or
yes.
Tempeh. I've always said tempeh because that's what it looks like to me. But apparently it's pronounced tempeh.
Yes. I believe that is true. And I've been campaigning for a tiny tempeh joke, but I don't think anyone will get it. For those two people out there that did, I feel you. We're on the same page.
All right. So tempeh, what is it?
It is very fun to explain. It's sort of a patty made up of cooked and partially fermented soybeans. Tempeh can be used in a more general sense, referring to a wide range of mold-fermented foods. That is a fantastic phrase.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, it's used to refer to soy tempeh.
In the United States, many brands that sell tempeh add other legumes or grains or seeds in with the soy, like barley, black beans, or sesame seeds, to add to the texture and flavor.
Right. Taste-wise, it's kind of nutty and earthy, mushroomy. It's got some texture to it, and it's good in sandwiches and stir-fries.
Yeah, soy tempeh is sort of like a chewy, springy, soft burger patty. The soybeans in it are whole, or halved, really, and bound together with kind of softer stuff. Raw, it looks sort of like nougat with nuts, or I guess like a slab of really dense mac and cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tempeh has a stronger, savory flavor than tofu does and tastes a little bit less greeny or beany than most tofu. It's actually my favorite meat substitute.
Oh, I was just about to ask if you liked it.
Yeah, if you're going for a vaguely meaty texture, maybe it's just tied with seitan, which is a wheat product in a whole other episode.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Are you a tempeh fan?
I've only had it a couple of times, and after doing the research on this, I want to rectify that. I did like it every time I had it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways you can cook it. Mm-hmm. It can be boiled or fried. After you get past fried, why are you doing anything else with it?
Yeah.
Crumbled into soups or stews. Yeah.
I went to this diner in Chicago, and it was an all-vegan diner.
Oh, wow.
And I've been trying to remember the name of it forever, so if any listeners know, it was near... Is it Fisherman's Wharf? That's San Francisco. That big place with the Ferris wheel, Lauren.
I've never hung out in Chicago.
Okay. Well, they have a big dock thing. And it was near there, and it was a vegan restaurant, and I had tempeh for the first time, and I remember really enjoying it. Anyway, listeners, please write in if you know what place I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Back to tempeh in our episode and not random remembrances of Annie. Tempeh originates in Indonesia. The name itself is Indonesian and is especially popular on Java. Beginning in at least 1875, the Indonesian spelling of tempeh usually involved an accent on the final E and no H. But when Malaysia and Indonesia modernized their languages to make them more similar in 1972, the accent was dropped. To make sure they didn't pronounce it like temp, European and English languages added the H on the end. The spelling shows up way earlier in Germany in 1896. The first written English spelling didn't appear until 1950. And if we're talking about health, tempeh is a popular vegetarian and vegan food, particularly as a meat substitute. A 3-ounce serving boasts 16 grams of protein. For comparison, the same amount of steak only has 10 more grams than that. It's fairly high in calcium and iron and has zero cholesterol. It is similar to tofu, but less processed.
It's not particularly low in fat, but it's got some of those good omega-3s and omega-6s that you want. And along with the protein, its fat content will help fill you up and keep you going. The fermentation process that tempeh undergoes increases the amount of easily bioavailable vitamins and minerals in the soy or whatever else the tempeh is made of, meaning that you will get more out of those base ingredients once they're fermented and therefore partially broken down already than you would get if they had not been fermented. So that's nifty.
That is nifty. What else is nifty is I remembered the name of that Chicago thing. It's Navy Pier. I don't remember the restaurant. But I remember it's not Fisherman's Wharf, it's Navy Pier. So don't yell at me about that.
Okay, perfect.
A 2015 study out of the University of Alabama suggested that soy proteins may have anti-inflammatory properties and possibly even anti-tumor effects, as long as you don't go overboard. And of course, as always, on this show, more science, needs to be done.
Yeah. For a little bit more about the health of soy products in general, you can see our tofu episode.
Yeah.
I do a pretty big breakdown of all of that. And the answer is essentially don't be too afraid of it, but don't eat it maybe every meal.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Bodies are complex.
Mm-hmm. But more science needs to be done.
Absolutely.
But now let's run some numbers.
Ooh, numbers.
Y'all, as it turns out, the tempeh industry is holding its cards real close to its chest. Without spending $4,000 on a detailed market report, I can tell you that consumption of plant-based foods meant to replace meat-based foods is on the rise in the United States. As of 2017, sales of tofu and tempeh together were worth about $99 million and expected to increase. And NPR reported in 2013 that one Mr. Hendoko, the manager of a tempeh-producing co-op village in West Jakarta, expected that, and I quote, with government support and media promotion, in 20 years' time, tempeh will conquer the world.
Huh. I like that.
I do.
Me too. Yeah. Good for you, tempeh.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's time to talk about mold.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Aren't we talking about mold?
Oh, yeah, we're talking about mold.
We are. But first, we're going to pause for a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes.
Okay, so as we mentioned, this is a mold modified fermented product. Take it away, Lauren.
Yes.
She's so excited.
So is this the first time we've gone in depth on mold?
Maybe.
I mean, we covered fungus during our episode on mushrooms, and this is sort of an offshoot of that, which is sort of a fungus pun. I am so excited.
It is. And we did get to try that mold at, remember when we did that?
Oh, right. Absolutely. Yeah, one of the mold culture starters out at
Holman and Finch.
Holman and Finch. Thank you. With our powers combined, we can remember the name of one of these restaurants we're talking about. Okay. So the easiest way to explain how the mold in tempeh works is by explaining how you go about making tempeh. And I'm going to roll with the example of soy tempeh for simplicity's sake here. So, okay, you start with soybeans, mm-hmm. raw or dried, though if they're dried, you have to soak them first to make sure that they are soft enough to de-hull, because you've got to get rid of that tough seed coat or hull to make the nutritious bits of the beans available for the fungus to eat.
Ooh, fungus eating beans.
You cook the hulled beans until they're al dente, then cool to room temperature, and then you're ready to grow some tasty, tasty mold. The same way that you would add a starter culture to milk to make yogurt, or to dough to make sourdough bread, or to like plant juice to make beer or wine, you add a starter culture to soybeans to make tempeh. You're looking for the microorganisms to develop the flavors and textures that you want in the finished product. The starter culture might be a dried mix that you've bought, or it might be a little bit of your last batch of tempeh. Again, the same as in sourdough production. Additional microbes, like yeasts or lactic acid bacteria, are often a part of the starter culture for tempeh, but let's concentrate on the mold for right now.
Let's.
Two specific types of mold fungus are usually used to make tempeh, both in the Rhizopus genus, R. oligosporus and R. oryzae. Rhizopus, by the way, we were talking about this before we started, and our amazing engineer for the day, Tyler Klang, pointed out that it sounds like a character from Thundercats.
It does.
And it does.
And also going to be a character in the upcoming The Dunker script. And if you've forgotten what The Dunker is, we haven't.
Oh, no.
No.
Never forget The Dunker.
Never.
Okay, so Rhizopus mold. As it turns out, these types of mold are really useful in food production for a few different reasons. First, they break down some plant cells so that they can eat the nutrients within, which also happens to make those nutrients more available for us to digest.
Uh-huh.
Second, their poop is just hella tasty and nutritious. They naturally excrete some compounds that we humans register as flavor and some that our bodies can use to feed our own cells. Mold poop!
Mold poop.
Oh.
A new bingo card entry, perhaps. I hope we get to talk more about mold poop.
I know, right? Oh, I think we will.
Okay.
Third, They don't want too much competition from other microorganisms, so they can produce antifungal and antibacterial compounds, which helps keep harmful microbes out of your finished food product. So just like high fives all around. Rhizopus.
Yeah. Rhizopus. Rhizopus. Got a theme song.
We do. Mm-hmm. So you add your starter culture to your cooked soybeans, then create an environment for the microbes to do their work in a controlled way. That's going to be a mostly sealed container, like a Ziploc bag with a few holes poked in it, or tightly wrapped banana leaves if you're going traditional. That keeps the humidity up and prevents too many free-flowing microbes from getting in there. And Rhizopus likes to grow between about 85 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 29 to 32 Celsius. So you'll want to keep the temperature consistently in that range. Mm-hmm. The rhizopus will grow on the soybeans, feeding off of them and producing shoots or fungal filaments or the mycelium. If you listened to our episode on mushrooms, in fungus, the mycelium is sort of the vegetative or root system of the organism. In mushrooms, it's what spreads out underground, which the mushrooms then shoot up from. But in your tempeh, it just covers and binds the soybeans together. Over the course of a day or two, your soybeans will be completely covered by the mycelium and firmly bound together into a cake. And then it's ready to eat, or to cook and eat if you would like, because it can be a little bit bitter when it's raw. So, tempeh tastes sort of mushroomy because it's partially a fungus.
Makes sense.
Which might sound a little bit gross, but it's really so cool. You're creating proto-mushroom to eat along with your soybeans.
Yeah. That's pretty rad. And also, it looks cool.
It looks so cool, yeah. And there are recipes online if you would like to try to do this yourself. The Kitchen has a really thorough one that I'll try to remember to link somewhere on social. Oh, y'all, I get so excited about fermentation. And what always gets me about fermented products is that humans noticed that they happen.
Yeah.
And that the results are tasty. Without having any idea why.
Mm-hmm.
And then spent years and probably centuries and probably millennia unwittingly, but like really effectively developing and farming these colonies of microorganisms to make their product safer and tastier. And now science can tell us more or less how it works, and it's only even more badass.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's beautiful.
It is. Thank you, mold poop.
Thank you, mold poop. Well, let's talk about the history of this mold poop.
Yeah.
But first, let's take one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes. Okay, so the history on tempeh is difficult to pin down, and there isn't a lot easily available research on it in
right.
English,
yeah.
At least from what I could ascertain.
From what I've read, a lot of the ancient stuff has kind of been lost to the ages because it's certainly not that the people making it weren't writing about stuff. They just weren't writing about their food that much.
Right. But food historians think it originated on Java in Indonesia around 1800 CE, but it could be up to 1,000 years older. One theory I read, it's even 2,000 years older.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's fairly a large range. The first written mention from the region dates back to 1815 CE. However, this mention is describing, allegedly accurately, the period from 1613 to 1645 CE.
Huh.
Yeah, it's really...
That's a large range of possibilities.
It really is. I was kind of staring dumbfounded at my computer. What? The reason food historians believe it may go back way further is that it's so widespread on the island of Java. Even the most remote areas have several varieties, and it's such an important element of local cuisine. 41,000 shops were using up to 17 indigenous seeds and press cakes by the 1970s, for instance.
Ooh.
Yeah. Written records of soybeans in Indonesia go back to 1747 CE, but soybeans probably were introduced with the opening of trade routes to China in 1000 CE. Around that time, the Chinese were using mold to make their soy sauce in a similar method to the one used to make tempeh. It could be that the Chinese brought over this process and it evolved in Indonesia from there. There's so many possibilities. Mm-hmm. Originally, tempeh was most likely made using high-protein cake byproducts of the oil pressing process for things like peanuts or coconuts. And also the soy pulp left behind when making soy products like tofu and various other agricultural byproducts that otherwise would go to feeding livestock or to waste. Mm-hmm. An article in 1900 CE described the process of making tempeh pretty thoroughly. Soybeans were parboiled, soaked for a couple of days in water, steamed, and spread out on bamboo trays and covered with banana leaves. Once that time had passed, some of the leftover mold residue from the previous batch was mixed in, and the banana leaves were loosely replaced. The author noted that during fermentation, the temperature increased anywhere from 10 to 12 degrees Celsius. After some remolding, a little more waiting, the tempeh was sliced and ready for the selling. Mm-hmm. About tempeh made with coconut press cake. It's sort of notorious for sometimes going toxic and causing food poisoning and or death.
Oh.
Yeah. The first written case of this was reported in 1895 by the Dutch, but the locals said it had been around since they started making tempeh with coconut press cake. During times of economic hardships, these cases would increase since people would attempt to make their own tempeh with coconut at home.
Ah.
10 to 12 cases a year were reported during Indonesia's economic depression from 1931 to 1937. Local legend was the angry spirit or goddess of the Indian Ocean was behind it. In the years from 1933 to 1938, 9 studies were published about the poisonings and the bacterium they discovered was causing it, and I read them, and it was interesting, but also my brain was like, nope. This is a lot more in-depth than I was intending. A couple of studies published in the early 1910s and 20s found that the protein in tempeh was high quality, a good complement to rice, and that tempeh had a good amount of vitamins A, B1, and B12. Previous to that, and after really, not much scientific evaluation of tempeh took place because it was seen as an inferior foodstuff for the poor. This sentiment lasted even after Indonesia secured their independence, with the president of the country from 1945 to 1967 making statements like, don't be a tempeh nation or don't be a tempeh scientist.
Oh, harsh.
Yeah. During World War II, Indonesia and many surrounding countries fell under Japanese control, and tempeh became a vital food source for both the indigenous population and prisoners of war, despite a lot of the native starter cultures being lost in the war.
Oh.
I know. A written account from a prisoner of war credits tempeh for preventing many deaths. The fermentation of the soybeans made them more easily digestible for the sick prisoners of war as well.
Yeah.
After a long, violent conflict with the Dutch, Indonesian independence was recognized in 1949. Some survivors during and after the war chose to immigrate all around the world, bringing tempeh with them. Tempeh wasn't commercially produced in Europe until sometime between 1946 and 1959. 18 tempeh-producing companies were operating out of Europe by 1984. And if you're like me, that's very recent. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the U.S., the first written mention of tempeh appeared in 1946, and Indonesian immigrants in the U.S. produced the first commercially available tempeh in 1961. Starting in the 1960s, the USDA and Cornell University started doing research on tempeh, which ignited tempeh scientific interest in Indonesia, uh-huh. inspiring headlines in Indonesian newspapers like, "Tempeh steps up to a higher throne." These studies suggested that Rhizopus oligosporus may be effective against the bacterium behind staph and other gram-positive bacteria. Here's my favorite finding, though. A study out of Berkeley in 1971 concluded that despite being made from beans, tempeh did not cause flatulence.
That's right.
What's that kid saying? Beans, the musical fruit.
The more you eat, the more you toot.
Kids know it, mm-hmm. but not tempeh.
Yeah, the mold's already eaten all of the flatulence-causing compounds.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, mold.
Thank you. From 1979 to 1984, the number of American facilities producing tempeh went from 13 to 53.
Oh.
Yeah. In 1961, only the second scientific look at tempeh out of Indonesia came with this quote. The time will come when Indonesians will be proud of their tempeh in the same way as the Japanese are proud of their sake, the French people of their wine, Italians of their macaroni, Indians of their curry, the Russians of their caviar, the Dutch of their cheese.
Oh.
Yeah. In part thanks to the efforts of the study's author, a search for ways to improve traditional tempeh starters in Indonesia began in the 60s. As we touched on in the tofu episode, the U.S. started exporting a ton, or 156,000 tons in 1976, and about double that by 1983, of soybeans to Indonesia. Before that, tempeh had been traditionally made out of domestically grown soybeans, which were more resistant to going rancid than the U.S. variety, and they were larger. Well, the U.S. variety was larger, cheaper, and cleaner.
Right.
Still, 64% of imported U.S. soybeans went to making tempeh in Indonesia. Behind the manufacturing of tempeh were 41,201 producers, a good portion of them small and family-run.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The tempeh industry employed 128,000 people and amounted to a retail value at the time of $85 million. From 1951 to 1976, 7,216 cases of poisoning from coconut tempeh were reported and 86 deaths. In 1976, a Reader's Research Project sent 60 people throughout the U.S. a kit to grow their own tempeh with a questionnaire for feedback.
Huh.
And the feedback was almost universally positive.
Oh, heck yeah.
Prevention Magazine published an article in 1977 predicting that tempeh may become the most popular product of the soy boom and that, quote, tempeh was on its way up. Other health publications of the time predicted the same, one writing that tempeh appears to be the most likely candidate for Americanization. One health organization even espoused the benefits of tempeh in the diets of cancer patients. I'm pretty sure that magazine was set up entirely to do that, though.
Oh.
Yeah. I couldn't get a real feel for it, but I have my suspicions. The first book describing how to set up commercial tempeh production plants was published in 1980, the same year the world's first commercial tempeh burgers were introduced.
Ah.
Yeah. In 1982, tempeh starters could be found on Indonesian grocery shelves. One of my favorite tempeh ad slogans, all the sizzle, none of the steak. Love it. If we look at Japan, we don't see any written references until 1928. But when soy milk surged in popularity in Japan in 1983, so too did the popularity of tempeh, and production grew correspondingly. A year later, Japan had the largest tempeh company in the world.
Ah.
Yeah. There was sort of a frenemy thing that happened with natto and tempeh.
Oh, fermented soy products versus fermented soy products. Yeah.
Yeah. Oof. An article published in 1983 came with this headline, natto that doesn't smell. Even young people like it. Okay. And remember that Indonesian tempeh researcher from earlier, he returned to his home country in 1984 after researching in the U.S. and wrote of the occasion, tempeh is no longer considered an inferior food. Nowadays, Indonesians are as proud of their tempeh as the Japanese are of sake and French of their wine! Exclamation point. Warms my heart.
So much.
Yeah.
it is. It is something to be proud of. Yeah. It's a delicious and useful food. It's cheap and it's real nifty.
It really is. I wish that more of the history was available and clear. So get on it, anyone out there who has the ability to do so.
Yeah.
We would greatly appreciate it here at Foodstuff.
We very much would.
Yes. But that brings us to...
Listener Mail.
Does it? Yes,
it does.
It does. It does.
Yep, that's our tempeh episode, Listener Mail.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jason wrote... Back around the turn of the century, I had a gig working at a little bar that featured several drinks that ended in teeny. Lemon drop martini, apple teeny, chocolatini, rimmed with hot chocolate powder, no less. You get the idea. This was also around the time when Sex and the City was getting really big.
Mm-hmm.
From the time I started to the time I left, there was a noticeable increase in the number of cosmopolitans we served every night. If you have never had a Cosmo, it is simply vodka, orange-flavored liqueur, and a splash of cranberry juice to give it the pink color. We used slightly better ingredients, Absolut, Citron, and Contreau, but it is a pretty stiff drink if you are more used to sweet and fruity cocktails. Mm-hmm. And being compassionate and customer-oriented people that had spent a number of years in the restaurant industry, on slower nights when a table ordered a round of Cosmos, we would place bets on how many would be sent back because the drinks were too strong.
Oh.
While it was never on the menu, we ended up offering a Cosmo Pineton, where we would add some pineapple juice and grenadine for those that discovered Carrie Bradshaw's favorite drink was a bit too much for them. It also seems we had a bit of a Churchill fan as a regular at the bar. He would order a dry martini with these instructions. Just whisper the word vermouth as you pour the gin, please. I responded to this email and I told him that I had a friend and she turned 21. I can't remember, but we were at a bar and I'd never seen Sex and the City, but all the rest of them had, and they all ordered Cosmos, and they definitely were like, oh.
this is a glass full of vodka.
This is very strong. And they all politely asked for, like, can you put a little something in here?
Oh.
Yeah. I think I got, like, a Bahama Breeze or something.
Much more gentle.
These were 21, well, young days. You're still discovering what you like.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think I had a Cosmo until after I started watching Sex and the City, because one of my boyfriends really liked it. But that was like after the show had been off the air for a couple of years. So I was old enough to appreciate a glass full of vodka. Megan wrote, I just recently discovered your podcast. Actually, sort of just discovered podcasts in general, huh? And I've been listening through to at least 2 episodes a day. Oh, thank you. I just finished the pineapple episode. I was surprised that SpongeBob was the only example of pineapple in the media. Everyone in Canada emailed you about Caesars, but not everyone in Canada emailed you about ananas?
No.
No one did. You're the first, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And here she inserted a picture.
Yeah. And I tried to scare Lauren with it, but it didn't work.
Yeah, sorry. I already done got scared by it at my desk.
Are you trying to think of the words to describe it?
I am. It's this pineapple puppet. It doesn't look pleasant.
She looks like how I imagine someone who's been drinking and smoking their entire life hard and never sleeps. Like, picture that in a pineapple's face.
But as a pineapple.
Also, it's like big green lips and half-lidded eyes, a sad, droopy pineapple crown of hair.
Mm-hmm. This creepy anthropomorphic pineapple taught us to speak French on a program we watched in elementary school on those old TVs on carts called Télé François. There are clips on YouTube. Check it out.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out.
It's delightful. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I was shocked and then very pleased this exists.
It's horrifying and perfect. So, yes.
Definitely go look that up, should you be so intrigued.
Uh-huh.
And thanks to both of them for writing us. You, too, can send us an email. We would love to hear from you. Keep sending the pictures of pets with food names.
Oh, please do. Please. It's the very best.
It is. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at foodstuffhsw and on Instagram at foodstuff. We hope to hear from you. Thank you so much to the aforementioned Tyler Klang, our audio engineer for the day, and our super producer, Dylan Fagan. Thanks to you for listening. And we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.